We are driving roughly westward into central Florida, following the rail lines that were established before the Civil War in northern Florida. Those rail lines provided all of the major infrastructure for the state of Florida, and it was these railroad lines that became the axis of an invasion force that left Jacksonville and St. Augustine to attack Confederate forces located near Lake City, Florida. In the event, they clashed together at a place sometimes called Ocean Pond and sometimes called Alusty. The largest battle in Florida took place there on February the 20th, 1864. Most historians have tended to overlook Florida, considering it a military backwater of little real use to the Confederacy. However, in the course of the war, Florida provided more than 15,000 soldiers to the Confederacy, and those 15,000 men took very heavy casualties, and in fact, most of them never fought a single battle or set foot in their native state throughout the war. The state's economic and agricultural resources fed Confederate troops and civilians throughout Florida, Alabama, Georgia, and beyond. The Union coastal blockaders had some 1,600 miles of coastline to contend with and 6,000 miles of tidal shoreline. The landmass of the state was some 65,000 square miles, occupied by a population of only 155,000, 40% of whom were slaves. About 15 small battles and many raids and skirmishes took place in the course of the war in Florida. The largest battle in Florida, at a place called Alusty, is considered the third bloodiest battle in which the Union Army engaged in the war, per number of men involved, behind the Wilderness, Spotsylvania, and Port Hudson. Tallahassee was the only Confederate state capital unoccupied by federal forces at the end of the war. On January the 10th, 1861, the Ordinance of Secession was passed in Florida, in Tallahassee, by a vote of 62-7, the most overwhelming secession vote of all the Confederate states and the third state to leave the Union. One of the first things that the governor did was to order all federal military installations to be seized by Florida state troops and militias and turned over to the Florida government. Fort Pickens in Pensacola Harbor did not surrender. Although it only had an 81-man garrison in a bastion that was built for over 1,200 men, it refused to turn over, the commander of the fort refused to turn it over to Florida forces or Confederate forces. The first priority of the Confederate government of Florida was to occupy that Fort Pickens and the other forts, U.S. forts, around Florida and in Florida waters, and secondly, to create a Floridian army. The first year of organizing was one of frustration, confusion, and difficulty, and many felt that Florida was really the first state to be abandoned by the Confederate government. The federal arsenal at Chattahoochee was seized on January 6th, where they were able to acquire a cannon and 173,000 cartridges and over 5,000 pounds of gunpowder, gunpowder being one of the most necessary products for the conducting of a war based on black powder musketry and black powder artillery. Military supply difficulty is going to be characteristic of Florida's problem throughout the war. The state had little problem raising militia groups and raising troops for the Confederacy, but they had a terrible problem trying to arm them. In fact, the blockade runners who slipped out of the Florida harbors and made it to the nearest blockade ports, such as those found in Bermuda and in Havana in Cuba, would bring arms and ammunition into Florida, but it belonged to the Confederate government and not to the Florida government, and thus they could not secure the weapons that they needed to defend their own state. Fort Marion in St. Augustine was seized on January the 7th. Fort Marion is actually that great bastion that we were able to visit in St. Augustine, the one that the Spaniards had built and the Americans, the English had improved upon. But they also seized Fort Barrancas and Fort McKee, and the naval yard in Pensacola, but they could not take the fort, Fort Pickens. And in fact, many Floridians believe that the Civil War actually began in Florida, not at Fort Sumter. For a guard on the walls of Fort Pickens during the night, well before the shelling of Fort Sumter, fired on some Confederate troops that were in the vicinity and not too far from the wall. And that initial rifle shot from Fort Pickens, some claim, was the real first shot fired in the Civil War. The seizure of the Pensacola Naval Yards, by the way, was a great financial and industrial coup for the Confederacy. They were able to seize a dry dock, the marine workshops, warehouses, barracks, 175 cannons, 12,000 shells, and stores worth over $500,000. And so the Pensacola station was going to prove to be a real boon to Confederate supply efforts in the area. A major general of the Confederacy, Braxton Bragg, is going to be sent to Pensacola to hold that particular position until called elsewhere. President Buchanan ordered that no naval landings should be made at Pensacola. President Buchanan had been informed by the Confederate government, now meeting in Montgomery, Alabama, that if any attempts were made to resupply federal forts that did not give themselves up to the states, since they were on state property and technically then belonged to the states, that if they tried to resupply them or bring in reinforcements, it would be taken as an act of war against the Confederacy. So President Buchanan ordered the federal supply ships that were outside Pensacola to not try to land anything at the fort. He did not want to aggravate the situation and start the war by doing something that was considered aggressive against the Confederacy. Most Florida militias were privately supplied, and they were poorly trained. Initially, a cavalry regiment, two infantry regiments were to be raised, but of course, the call for troops went out very shortly thereafter for many more regiments that could be raised. Recruitment centers were in Tallahassee, in Apalachicola, in Gainesville, in Pensacola, Jacksonville, and other places. On April the 1st, 1861, the 1st Florida Infantry Regiment mustered into Confederate service. Thousands and thousands of men had enlisted in the Confederate Army in Florida, but there were not enough weapons. The Confederate government told the Florida government to send the boys home if they couldn't arm them. And what a difficult situation that made for the Florida government. They had thousands of recruits willing to fight for their state and fight for the Confederacy, but they couldn't supply them or arm them. By the end of 1861, Florida had raised over 6,700 troops and had organized them into four regiments of infantry, one cavalry, and four artillery companies. The new governor, Milton, was going to prove to be a pretty good war governor in Florida, although unpopular at times because of some of the measures he had to take. In April of 1862, all Confederate forces in Florida were ordered to reinforce the Army of the Tennessee. And unfortunately, at the same time that they were ordered up in April of 62 to join the army that was going to attack General Grant at the Battle of Shiloh, at the same time, the states of Georgia and Florida both did not renew their militia bills. And so the practical effect was that Florida was going to be left undefended. Brigadier General Joseph Finnegan, an Irish-born immigrant, came to America in his 20s and settled in Florida. He was a planter and a lumberman. settled in Fernandina, which is going to be a very key town in the Civil War Florida, associated himself with Senator David Yulee in the railroad business in Florida. And he was appointed in charge of military affairs for the state. It was a political appointment. General Finnegan was going to, throughout the war, prove to be an adequate officer, and he's going to receive the credit for the great Confederate victory at Olustee. He serves in Florida and in the Army of Tennessee, and then in Virginia in May of 64 through March of 65, and he's going to eventually lead Florida troops at the Battle of Cold Harbor and other engagements of the Overland Campaign, and then he was returned to Florida duty till the end of the war after that. Blockade runners went in and out of Florida ports, and the use of blockade runners was one of the lifelines that was so important to the Confederacy. No state had a longer coastline to defend, but it was also the longest coastline to attack, and blockade runners could slip in and out of Florida. The problem, however, for the Confederacy in Florida was that there was no way to get the supplies once they were smuggled into Florida ports and up Florida rivers. There's no way to get them, or it was very difficult to get them, the supplies to the armies that needed them, because the railroad mileage in Florida was only in the north, and it was mostly east and west instead of north and south. So anything that came in the Florida Keys, any blockade runners that brought goods into any city or any town south of St. Augustine or along the Atlantic coast on the Gulf side, I should say the Gulf Coast, had a difficult time getting those supplies where they were needed. The only railroad in Florida was in North Florida, and it went from Jacksonville to Tallahassee with a number of way stations along the way. And the Battle of Olustee is going to be fought midway between Jacksonville and Tallahassee at one of those rail junctions. So it became the most important lifeline for the Confederacy in Florida for transporting troops and supplies, getting them through Tallahassee and then north into Georgia, Alabama, and Tennessee. The federal government in Washington was able to hold all the forts in the Florida Keys, and they were able to hold Pensacola Harbor. And so the most important strategic points are going to be held off and on by the federal blockaders. They're going to capture Jacksonville. They're going to capture St. Augustine. In fact, Jacksonville will be captured four different times and abandoned three times in the course of the war. The reality was the federal Navy and whatever soldiers were sent there to garrison those places only held the town where they stood. They only controlled the land they stood on. The vast majority of Florida was out of their reach and in the hands of the Confederacy. And as time goes on, the supplies that Florida is able to produce to send to the armies, especially the Army of Tennessee, are going to help keep them in the field. Florida is going to prove to be a great supply base for the Confederacy. Confederate garrisons were put at St. Vincent's Island, St. Mark's, Apalachicola, Tampa, Cedar Key, Fort Marion, Fort Clinch. The most strategic points, though, were the ports that were connected by the railroad from Jacksonville and Fernandina, Cedar Keys, and Tallahassee. The densest plantation and largest black population was at Tallahassee or in the environs of Tallahassee, so many miles from the Gulf. On the Atlantic, Fernandina and Apalachicola in the Gulf were the two most important Confederate locations, 250 miles apart, and Fernandina was seized by the Federals fairly early in the war. In fact, January 29, 1862, they seized that, capturing 15 cannons. St. Augustine and Jacksonville fell a few days after that. So in the first month of 1862, the key positions in Florida, the key towns, the most important places, had fallen to federal troops. When Jacksonville fell, a number of people who lived in that city signed oaths of loyalty to the Union. And shortly after they pledged their loyalty and their faithfulness to the United States government, the federal troops withdrew from Jacksonville and the Confederates came back in, which, as you might guess, created some awkward situations and difficult explanations as to why individuals would sign oaths of allegiance to the Union. The reality was that although the secession vote in Florida was so overwhelmingly pro-Confederate, the actual population of Florida was, there was a strong minority pro-Union element in the state. And as part of the strategy that the Union had of trying to seize Florida to bring it back into the Union, part of that overall strategy was to get in touch with those who were for the Union and to try and encourage them and eventually bring them into the solution, the governmental solution of the federal government to the Confederate obstinacy. When General Finnegan was put in command in Western Florida, and that was the name of his command, he only had 1,800 troops at his disposal, and he was ordered to defend the interior of Florida. If you look on a map, you'll see that that's a considerable amount of territory, and those were just a handful of troops in reality. So the feeling in Florida was, among Floridians, the governor and the officials and the people, was that the Confederate government in Richmond had actually abandoned Florida to their own devices, that they did not consider it important enough to establish an army there to defend the borders of the Sunshine State. General Finnegan said this about Florida. He said, "There is not within my knowledge a portion of the state free of skulking traitors, the majority of them of northern birth and claiming to be citizens of Florida." I guess times probably haven't changed all that much. But General Finnegan saw snowbirds already living in Florida and causing trouble behind Confederate lines. There was a strong movement in the region for the Union, generally generated by people known as come-froms. The center part of the state was the most hardcore as far as the Confederacy support and loyalty to the Confederacy was concerned. Most of those who were called traitors were in Jacksonville and Pensacola and St. Augustine and places where there was trade and ports and merchants and business. That's where the strongest Union support was located. So it made it easy for Union gunboats and Union Navy to take those places, which they did from time to time. However, the blockade runners continued plying their trade throughout the war. The blockade was designed to isolate primarily the agricultural states, or the most important agricultural states, and force the Confederacy to depend on the outside world for necessities. And then secondly, to prevent the export of cotton. One of the big mistakes that Jefferson Davis made early in the war was to develop a policy whereby he would starve the European countries that were dependent upon Confederate cotton, Southern cotton, to deprive them of that staple. And so the Confederates warehoused millions of pounds of cotton at the beginning of the war, and it was their number one resource for income. Cotton was gold. Cotton was the same as gold. And it would be cotton that would purchase arms and cannons and gunpowder and all the things that were needed to fight the war. It was cotton that was necessary to be warehoused in Europe, not in the South. The Confederacy realized its mistake too late, and as the blockade stiffened, it was more difficult to get cotton when they finally realized that that was that was what they needed to use as currency. They realized it was too late to get it out. Confederate policy and Union blockade policy happened to work together to the detriment of the Confederacy. Once, of course, that was realized that that was a foolishness and counterproductive, they began trying to export cotton on the blockade runners to use them in trade for the things that they, the necessaries that had to come through the blockade. There were numerous inlets in which a blockade runner could quietly slip in, could pile some cotton into his ship and get off to Bermuda or Havana or some other port in the Caribbean and trade his cotton for the necessities of war. Also, one of the repercussions of Confederate policy regarding cotton, just as an aside, is that although it did hurt the mills, the cotton mills in England, and it resulted in the mill workers and the mill owners in England being pro-Confederate, they turned to India for their cotton, and the South was replaced by other cotton growers around the world. So a very strategic economic mistake at the beginning of the war. However, the Floridians sought to get their cotton out to the neutral ports in Bermuda. Nassau was only 180 miles. That was the closest and most important blockading port to go to. Havana was number two. Matamoros was another good port, but particularly Nassau and Havana. The main Confederate ports in the Confederacy were Savannah and Charleston, Mobile, New Orleans, and Wilmington. And so there were none of those ports were in Florida. And so the concentration of the blockade was on those cities. Charleston held out right up until 1865. Savannah fell to William Tecumseh Sherman in 1864. Mobile held out right up to the bitter end in 1865. New Orleans fell very quickly early in the war. Wilmington held out quite a long while, too. So U.S. naval bases were established in Florida to try and blockade the coast at Fernandina and St. Augustine. There they, of course, utilized the St. John's River, which if you look on a map, you can see the importance, the strategic importance of that river and the ease by which Union shipping could go up and down. Most Florida operations were small boats up inlets that would, the cotton boats that would try to slip out. And most of the Florida operations of the Union fleet were just small boats going up those inlets looking for cotton to steal. The boarding parties, raids on salt works, sort of a slow strangulation of the Florida economy was the purpose of the Union blockade. Another purpose of the blockade, not only to deprive the Confederacy of the economic benefits of trading in cotton, but also the Union raids were designed to recruit the slaves to serve in the Federal Army. Now, this came a little later in the war. It wasn't the very first idea they had, but once the idea took hold, recruiting black troops for black regiments became a high priority. And in Florida, in the course of the war, some 1,100 slaves were recruited by the federal troops, ran away, came to the federal army, and were put into the army. By the end of the war, there were about 179,000 black troops in blue uniforms. 99,000 of those, that is a little over half, were from the South, and about one-tenth of the adult black male population of Florida was under arms and in uniform by the end of the war. The first South Carolina Volunteers was the very first Southern black regiment, led by Colonel Thomas W. Higginson. He's one of the Secret Six, a friend of John Brown. He became the commander of that regiment. And they made a raid up the St. Mary's River in South Georgia and down into Florida around Fernandina. The first and the second South Carolina was commanded by Colonel James Montgomery, who was a radical free soiler from the days of Bloody Kansas. So both of these regiments, black regiments, are going to shock the people of Florida and Georgia as they bring black troops into the interior of those two states and call for slaves to leave their plantations and to enlist in the Union Army. Strategically, the railroad from Jacksonville to Baldwin to Tallahassee and to Cedar Key was the only infrastructure in Florida. The roads were poor. Most products were gotten into Georgia by ox cart and wagon, but some things were able to travel by railroad. Because of the lack of enough railroad iron to continue railroad building, the Confederates would dismantle rail lines and then relay them in the direction they needed them to go. And so the railroads could change position from time to time. The federal general who was put in command of North Florida was General Gilmore. And he proposed seizing North Florida and eliminating the railroad access to Georgia. And he was high on recruiting black soldiers. There was also a proposal to colonize Florida and turn it into a Yankee state. That is, bring down colonists from New England. And once they see how beautiful Florida is, once they get the opportunity to go to Orlando and see Mickey Mouse and all that, that they would want to stay. In fact, they might even want to retire there. And so General Gillespie and the federal government promoted emigration from New England down to Florida. A great force was gathered in Jacksonville in January and February of 1864, and that will become the subject when we arrive in Olustee, and we'll talk about the great battle that General Gilmore and General Seymour put together to try and destroy the Confederate railroad and to seize Confederate supplies and defeat any Confederate army that they would run across. I'd like to say a few things about the economic viability of Florida, because therein lies Florida's great importance. And one of the things I want to talk about is the necessity of the production of salt. Now, we understand that the beef industry in Florida was big and was very, very important, because the armies had to have meat. And as the war progressed after 1863, Florida became more and more economically important to the Confederacy. Eventually, the Union high command took notice that the Confederates were willing to send a lot of troops to Florida to protect the supply lines from Florida into Georgia and Alabama. And the battle that's going to result at Ocean Pond or Olustee is part of that whole idea that the Confederates were willing to defend Florida to keep the production of the necessary things that were being produced there to go to the armies, particularly the Army of Tennessee. Beef, pork, other agricultural commodities, but the most important was the production of salt. Now, you may wonder, why in the world is salt so important? Well, the meat that was going to go to the armies could only be preserved with salt. And there was a great, great need for salt. All preservation was done with salt. They didn't have freezers. They didn't have ice. They couldn't freeze their beef. And if they had to carry it on the, if they had to chase it on the hoof all the way to the army, the cattle wouldn't last very long or would be of poor quality. And that happened a number of times, and there was great complaint that Florida cattle were not fat enough and did not have the ability to feed the armies very well. So it was much better to butcher the cattle, to salt the meat. The salt had to be transported to the armies. It was all part of the logistics and the commissary of the Confederacy. And they did a tremendous job in getting the necessities to the army. Of course, they did the best job at getting gunpowder and caps and rifles to the army, but The army travels on its stomach. They can only go so far as they have food to eat. And Florida more and more became the supply depot for the armies in Alabama, Georgia, and Tennessee. Many planters continued the pre-war practice of dispatching gangs during slack periods to boil salt for their plantation's yearly needs. Where does salt come from? The largest supply of salt in the Confederacy was found in caves and in the ground up near Saltville, Virginia. The Federal Army, in fact, carried out a major, large raid against Saltville, Virginia, just to shut down the salt mines, because salt was absolutely necessary to the survival of the armies. Well, the rest of the salt, after 1863, Saltville continued to produce in Virginia, but the Deep South people, and civilians too, we're talking about having to supply civilians with meat as well as the armies. Most of the salt was going to come from the coast of Georgia, but especially the coastline of Florida. In fact, a number of salt makers from Georgia moved to Florida to produce salt. The salt was produced from seawater, and the process involved large iron kettles and brick ovens. It was quite an interesting process, and it could be done by anybody, and it could be done on a scale small or large. So plantations from time to time would form gangs to produce salt that would last them a certain amount of time. With the passage of time, defections increased among the slave labor force because of the Union attacks along the coast, and it also tended to decrease the production of salt. In the spring of 1864, Union forces stepped up their strikes on the salt works, in the St. Mark's area. One group, I'm quoting, by the way, from a very fine book that I will mention at the end that deals with these types of subjects. And the account is thus. One group raided up Goose Creek in March, capturing 2,000 bushels of salt, 165 kettles, 43 800-gallon boilers, and 98 brick furnaces. A Union officer in this instance noted that works had been destroyed, having the capacity of making 2,400 bushels per day. However, salt works like this one continued to rise from the ruins and quickly resumed production at near their former rate. So even though the federal troops would shut down salt works, it would just be a matter of days when they would be up and running again. There was an inexhaustible supply of seawater, and they built their salt works in the swamps and other places along the coast in which there was briny water. At most of the sites, the salt makers returned soon afterwards, and it was greatly annoying to the Union naval commanders who kept sending out patrols and small boats to try and shut down the assault works. Also, not just the Union attacks on salt works were a danger. They were also, weather posed a deadly peril. Quoting again, fierce winds and rapidly rising water caught, and this was in the St. Mark's region, a big tropical storm came. Furnaces were swept away and large iron kettles were carried hundreds of yards from the works. Houses, tents, and boats were demolished, and at least 40,000 bushels of salt were returned to the sea. Some 35 mules and 8 oxen drowned in the floodwaters, and more than 30 salt makers, black and white, perished. Surviving owners of the flooded salt works quickly commenced repairs. And so the salt works and the salt production for the Confederacy from Florida was prodigious, it was important, and it was largely successful, because even though destroyed from time to time, it could go right back into production. If you had an iron pot and a kiln, you could produce salt. Also, the makers of salt were exempt from military service. So deserters and men from other states moved to Florida to work in the salt works to get away from military service. And many of them were slackers, and there were lots of complaints that some of the salt workers produced very little or nothing. Eventually, the Confederate government said that salt workers could be drafted into the army. But the states actually protested that if they didn't get the salt, if the salt teams were disbanded, the Confederacy would be so badly damaged from the lack of salt that it would be tragic. And so the Confederate government actually withdrew that requirement. I want to mention, too, that in terms of economics, the Florida beef production was absolutely prodigious. I'm going to read a concluding paragraph regarding the importance of the beef production that went from Florida, keeping in mind that it's hand-in-hand with salt production. A year-end look at a single Florida commissary district shows the extent of cattle shipments to the Confederate armies in 1863. Charleston received 5,679 head from the 4th District that year, while Savannah took delivery of 899. The Army of Tennessee consumed some 3,500 cows during the long campaign ending in the debacle around Chattanooga. When requisitions for units stationed in Florida itself are included, this one district sent over 10,000 head of beef cattle to the Confederate forces. So, although Confederate armies were notorious for having poor diets, Florida was able to provide a great deal of beef to the Confederate service. The Union Army and Navy failed to completely isolate Florida from the rest of the Confederate South, try as they might. But they did have some real achievements against the Confederate economy. No one can be certain what the effect of a large-scale invasion of the peninsula after the fall of Vicksburg might have, been on the South's ability to feed itself. But it's reasonable to conclude that completely removing Florida as a source of supply could very well have, to some degree, hastened the final defeat of the Confederacy. And finally, I want to mention a Florida and Confederate hero who was known as the Confederate Swamp Fox. His name was John Jackson Dickinson. He had a force that rarely exceeded 200 men, and he frustrated Union attempts to occupy Florida over and over again. He raised a cavalry company early in the war, and one of his sons was killed in a skirmish, in one of the battles, actually, in Florida. But he had an independent command of about 200 cavalry, and he used them to great effect against Union depredations along the coast. They never knew when Dickinson would show up with his troops and ambush a company of soldiers that were, say, going out to destroy a salt works, or that were trying to steal some cotton, or whatever it was that they were up to. Dickinson and his men would drop in on them. Towards the end of the war, he began setting up ambushes against Union gunboats along the Florida rivers. He, in fact, captured the USS Columbine in an ambush, which sixteen Union soldiers were killed, and the rest of them captured. He also picked off other companies and captured men from the 4th Massachusetts Cavalry, the 3rd Rhode Island Artillery, the 75th in Ohio Mounted Infantry. A number of different Connecticut troops were captured by Dickinson or killed in his fights in the swamps along the coast of Florida. He was likened to Francis Marion from the War for Independence and became a Florida hero. In fact, his nickname was, the Federals gave him a nickname of Dixie, and they considered everything west of the coast Dixie's land because Colonel Dickinson was so effective in stopping the Union attacks along the coast. Well, with that, I will conclude this lecture on Florida in the Civil War. After the Battle of Alusty, there are very few engagements, virtually none. Well, there's a couple battles after Alusty, but they're minor. And when the war comes to an end, Tallahassee is still standing proud and independent as the only state capital of the Confederacy unoccupied by federal troops. I would like to recommend to you, if you want to know more about the Civil War in Florida, a book entitled Confederate Florida, The Road to Olustee by William Nolte, which is a very good record of the sort of the military aspects of the war in Florida, and another book entitled Rebel Storehouse, Florida's Contribution to the Confederacy, from which I quoted several things by Robert Taylor. There are also several regimental histories of Florida units and some Georgia regimental histories too, Footprints of a Regiment, a Recollection of the 1st Georgia Regulars, just an example of one by a sergeant in the 1st Georgia. But there are always regimental histories that do shed some light on individual units. Most Florida units, however, did not serve in Florida. Their records would be of fighting for the Confederacy in the armies in Virginia and Tennessee.